Next, we have Dr. Rex Archer, the Director of Health for the City of Kansas City, Missouri. Dr. Archer has been in its current position for, I believe it's approximately 27 years or so. He's a longtime public health physician with wide experience before he came to Kansas City. His department under his leadership has won numerous national awards, and Dr. Archer himself is a past president of the National Association of County and City Health Officials. He is an expert on gun violence. He's done exciting things in Kansas City, and we're looking forward to hearing what those things are and how they might help communities around the country. Thank you.
Yeah, my only disagreement with that intro is I'm not sure that anyone is really an expert on gun violence. I think we're still all spending time trying to learn about this. I want to go back to a question that was also asked earlier. I don't know too many police chiefs around the country, particularly in more urban areas, that if the medical society got together and said, we'd like to meet with you, that they wouldn't meet with you. And so hopefully I'll be giving you some information here, and there are a number of us around. We're blessed with a police chief that actually is working through and training the law enforcement folks to understand how to de-escalate a situation, and even though that's difficult, and it's a kind of an aside piece, but we know from a neurobiology and a brain development standpoint that actually men in particular have to get to at least 25 before they're at a point where they really should be even handling these kinds of situations. Now, we're not at the point of raising the age to get into the military or law enforcement to 25, but probably should be, because I'm not sure that from the brain development standpoint that we can actually handle those situations. The other thing I want to mention is if there are any folks that have been in the military or have been involved with situations with red lasers, this pointer is a red laser, so before I use it, I'd just like to warn the audience, because if you've been under those kinds of environments, you can get stressed from that. So, for thousands of years, we have struggled with various kinds of issues, and if it's communicable diseases in particular, what happened? We often blame the individual for the disease. And we not only blame the individual for the disease, but we often lock them up. And when we didn't understand multiple diseases, we might actually be locking people with multiple different kinds of diseases in crowded settings and spreading several epidemics at the same time. And when we lock up people now for nonviolent offense, we are now teaching them how to be violent often because of the environment that we're putting them in. So if you think about it, and you look at how many blacks we have in college in this country, and we have, what, about almost 80% of that number are in prison or on probation right now. We're actually training almost as many people in violence as we are in higher education. That's a structural problem. Now, if you think about the horizontal x-axis and y-axis, and whether it's various sacred texts and religions. The x-axis here, horizontal axis, is the axis of justice. And so in our various sacred texts, you'll see a continuum. And on the left, what happens normally when you say justice in this country, for most people, what do they immediately do? They put criminal in front of the word, and they're thinking about retribution and punishment, or even we've got to show revenge. On the other hand of justice, on this continuum, we have restorative, distributive, and contributive justice. And in all of our major religions and sacred texts, that whole spectrum of justice is there. But mostly people tend to look through one lens on one side. In the same regards, we have a y-axis, up and down, and that's power and influence. And if you think about it, force, violence, threats, or nonviolent persuasion. And in fact, all violence starts with ideology of the other and then moves to rhetorical violence against the other and then can be physical violence against the other. But until you identify them as the other, it's hard to do the other two. And guess what? We have four quadrants here. And so in this quadrant, this is the normalcy of civilization. So as doctors in this country, we have to actually heal our civilization. Whether it was Sumeria, or Egypt under Pharaoh, or Caesar with Rome, or the British Empire, or the American Empire, we tend to operate largely down in this quadrant. Now, other developed countries that live longer than us have been moving into this other quadrant. And so that's part of our challenge. My dad used to say, son, there's three things you don't talk about in polite conversation: sex, politics, and religion. And as director of health with 480,000 patients, whether they know I'm their doctor or not, I have to talk about those every day. So let's think about this box on the right, the medical model, and this focus on individuals. Unhealthy behavior and risk factors we know lead to disease and injury lead to death. But if we move upstream or up the cliff, there's three kinds of parables in public health: the cliff story, the river story, and I may or may not get to questions on the third one. But so up here we talk about, instead of unhealthy behaviors and risk factors, we talk about societal behaviors and attitudes that are unhealthy, that lead to harmful policies and practices, that lead to neglected communities that are on life support. And so we can talk about emergency rooms to prevent death and clinics to work on disease and injury and health education for unhealthy behavior. But as we move from $3 trillion almost a year, twice as much per person as any other country in the world spends, and yet we don't live as long. Why? Because we neglect our communities. We have to develop endogenous leadership in our communities. We've got to look at our policies and practices. Our racial divide in Kansas City was created by the person that created the first plaza in this country, but he did all the kinds of redlining and blockbusting practices that kept blacks from being able to get loans and all kinds of issues that occurred in Kansas City. And ultimately, we have to change the narrative. Now, this is not easy. Talking about race sometimes can get you in trouble because we're learning. We make mistakes. You have to develop relationships and trust with folks and realize that you'll stumble at times. But we have to be more on inclusion and sustainability. We have to talk about health in all policies. Our city council unanimously passed this week, yesterday actually, support for Standing Rock. Mm-hmm. You know, that's, you know, 13 folks, 12 council members and the mayor stood up on Standing Rock. We have to then have more resilient and transformed communities. And ultimately, these are the real drivers of change. So this is the same model, the Bay Area Regional Health Inequities Initiative. 10 local health departments in the San Francisco Bay Area put resources together to develop this model. So it gives you a little more detail there in regards to the discriminatory beliefs, all the isms, whether it's class, race, gender, any way that we can separate ourselves from the other. I don't even use the term health disparities anymore than to say I don't use it, because it's too neutral in regards to the cause. So you either say it's health inequities or health injustices. So ultimately, we know what contributes to health. You've got genes and biology. Did you pick the right parents? physical environment, clinical care matters, but only about 10% on how long we live, health behaviors. And I predict that as the science continues to grow, the social economic factors will continue to grow in regards to their impact on health. And in fact, when we look at Kansas City, Missouri, you'll see population health issues. You can't bail fast enough if the social determinants have put that big a hole in your boat. And you'll see our six factors over here. 3 to 5 deaths every day on average in Kansas City, Missouri occur because of these six factors. That's 1 out of 3 to 1 out of 2 of my deaths because people didn't graduate from high school, our racial segregation challenges, individual poverty, income inequality. In fact, income inequality is the best predictor, really, of life expectancy between developed countries and also a very big predictor of homicides. In fact, I think about a third of our homicides in this country are really attributable to income inequality. So we have two theories. We have the punishment theory, which is traditional law enforcement. But think about it. If I am not worried that somebody is going to retaliate and shoot me or my loved ones because I've shot them, do you think I'm worried about being locked up or caught, particularly when I know a lot of us aren't getting caught, and even if we do get caught, there isn't enough places in the jail and somebody else is going to be discharged? However, the everything theory also is a little bit of a challenge because where do you start? Can you do everything? All of these are risk factors, but none of these are necessary or sufficient for violence. So when we think about this issue of the old view of bad people, enemies, incidents, and punishment, this kind of didn't format correctly here. So when we think about this, you've got the old view of bad people, but we now are seeing this as violence as a learned behavior. We're moving from thinking about people that are doing violence or the other as an enemy to we've got to actually change the norms. Can you imagine if somebody lit up a cigarette in here, how everybody would look at them? Can you imagine when somebody comes out of the prison system and they may have been smoking in that particular prison system, and they come back to an area that smoking isn't allowed, they get the social norm very quickly. But the same thing can happen if they pull out a gun in a bar and everybody looks at them like, that's not how we handle problems here. So we stop epidemics through interrupting transmission, preventing future spread, and changing norms. You know, we all know what tuberculosis can spread from person to person. You may have forgotten that it can be latent for decades before it breaks out again. And violence is the same way. You can plant the seeds for violence and they can stay unhealed in the body, almost like a spore ready to come out. We know the best predictors of violence is previous violence. You take the same housing projects with the same type of people, same social conditions, and if there wasn't violence in that housing project the last year, there probably won't be this year. But if there was, there'll be 30 times the odds and chances of violence continuing in that. It's a social norm and a learned behavior. So it has all the population characteristics of being communicable. Clustering, epidemic waves, and transmission. And what we see is cholera in Bangladesh, you see the clustering. Violence in Chicago, you see the clustering. Cholera in Somalia, you'll see the epidemic waves and even secondary waves. Violence in Rwanda. If you look at the spread of violence with the assassination of the Archduke in Bosnia, and then look at how this progresses. Russia enters the war, Germany and France mobilize, Britain, Germany, Turkey, Romania, Italy enters the war. Within about 4.5 years, we've got all these countries involved, and 15 to 20 million people died from this violence outbreak. So in Kansas City, we have a section here of 25 square miles, and you'll see, if you've got an eye test here, 83 to 71% of our deaths every year, out of about two deaths a week on average, it varies, are all in this area. Now we know transmission occurs across syndromes. If you're exposed to community violence and you observe it, you're more likely to be a perpetrator, a victim, or observer of community violence. You see the family violence and suicide. But what we also forget is those returning veterans, and Veterans Day, I think it's important to think about this, whether they were observers or victims, if they were actually hurt themselves, or perpetrators, even if it was under orders, they're more likely to come back and be perpetrators of community or intimate partner or child abuse because their brains have been damaged and they need healing. So how's this transmitted? Well, it turns out that just like cholera goes in through the mouth and grows in the body, violence is observed through the eyes and it changes the actual neural pathways, and we can see the changes that occur with the brain with continued exposure to violence. Changes the cortical and dopamine pain centers in the limbic regions. We all have probably experienced when we're out of control, and we're too angry, and we're not in our right mind, or our friends might be. Well, if you're ever in a situation, you may have an angry patient, or you may be in line someplace where a protest is going on. The way to help somebody get back into their frontal lobe is to start asking them questions. And they can't be just simply yes-no questions. You've got to get them a little more complex to where they have to move into their frontal lobe. The frontal lobe activity will actually start to suppress the amygdala, and you can help calm them and take them out of rage. And that's what our mediators are trained to do. Great workshop in 2012 with the IOM. You can get a copy of this report. It's very good for background on these issues. And just, again, remember, most of our behavior is learned. We have mirror neurons that imitate. These adults didn't train that child to walk that way. That child does that because that's the way the brain's set up to learn. So just as we have new strategies in these kinds of things, we have new methods of detection, case management, new types of workers. A lot of our homicides in most areas, in the urban areas in particular, are retaliation related. So we have a response team that goes to the hospital because that's the time to talk folks down, because if they start thinking about going out and retaliating, then you got problems. So you got to start asking them questions, getting them thinking about, even if the person dies, then you got to get them thinking about what? Funeral arrangements, other things, so that they're moving out of that rage center, and then you've got to spend a lot of intensive time with them over the next few weeks. So again, you interrupt transmission like you would with a communicable disease, you change behavior, and you shift the overall norm in your society. And I'm going to, in the interest of time, kind of pause there for questions, I think.